On November 23rd, in Santa Fe, we talked to Greg Mello, founder of the Los Alamos Study Group, on the proposed nuclear ban treaty in the United Nations. We spoke at Collected Works, so we have a bit of background noise from the cafe there. This is Robin Collier, KCEI, in Santa Fe with Greg Mello, talking about the proposed nuclear weapon bans from the United Nations. Yes. Tell us what this is all about.
Well, this is the first time that a treaty banning the possession, threat, use, development, testing, transfer of nuclear weapons has ever been proposed. And so last year, there was an so-called open-ended working group that produced ideas that would go toward banning nuclear weapons. And then there, in December, the General Assembly voted by a wide margin to go ahead and negotiate a treaty banning nuclear weapons, and the negotiations started in March with a week of countries expressing their views of what should be in the ban treaty, not actual negotiation, but just laying out what different countries' views were. And then the president of that conference, who is a Costa Rican ambassador, normally in Geneva, Elaine White Gomez, took in all of this information and with the help of UN staff that we know this, literally had a spreadsheet of different countries' positions on different aspects of the ban treaty. And from this spreadsheet, they looked at clustering and things in common that countries had. There's probably 6 or 10 countries that are the leading countries. There always would be, of course, in this effort, and their views are probably more important because they're the most active. And we know that they wanted a lean ban treaty that didn't try to include the kitchen sink and would be difficult to negotiate. And the General Assembly gave only 4 weeks negotiation time to produce this treaty. Because it's very expensive to run the United Nations with all the translators and everything. So the money is involved. So we had 1 week of preliminary views that were offered, and now we're going to have 3 weeks of negotiations, which we hope are final. The draft is very polished. It's lean and mean. And it covers all the bases, and it sticks right in the middle, in the bullseye, of what these countries want.
So there's broad support, I would presume, among all the nations that don't have nuclear weapons. Right. But these 10 or so that do, they're the problem, aren't they?
Well, let's see. It works out this way. There's 156 member states in the United Nations that don't have nuclear weapons and don't rely on a nuclear umbrella relationship. Yes, exactly. So there's 9 nuclear weapon states and there's 28 nuclear umbrella states, all of which are allied with the United States, as well as France and Great Britain. Only the West, so-called, has these nuclear umbrella relationships. So there's 37 states which have something to do with nuclear weapons, and they're not too enthusiastic about this treaty, with the 9 nuclear weapon states generally opposed. Now, within the 9, China abstained in the vote which set up these negotiations. So China's always been less pro-nuclear than, say, the United States or Russia. And they have a minimum deterrent. They don't want to invest heavily in nuclear weapons, and they just want to have enough to scare people away. North Korea, interestingly, voted for negotiations to prohibit nuclear weapons. And so there's some variation within the nuclear weapon states. But generally speaking, so we have 156 countries that don't have a relationship with nuclear weapons. Of those, well, let's see, all told, 132 countries have been involved in these negotiations so far. That includes Japan, that showed up for about an hour to condemn the negotiations. That's one. And then Netherlands was there more or less in a negative capacity, but the United States and its allies have boycotted these negotiations.
But I presume then what is the attempt here is to have all the other states that are for it vote unanimously, almost, the ones that don't have nuclear weapons, and embarrass those that do into changing their position. Is that a fair summation?
Yes, kind of. So it's a process. So this draft would go into force when 40 countries sign. And then other countries could join. So there might, you know, initially there might be 40, there could be 50, 90, 100, whatever it is. But then there would be a process. Crucial in this process is the role of U.S. allies. Western, especially democracies that have parliaments and consider themselves to be progressive or champions of human rights. So the basis of this treaty lies in humanitarian law and the tradition of human rights, which is very favored in these same countries which have nuclear umbrella relationships. This makes a politically combustible combination, and it's worrying the State Department. So what happens with these countries, you know, like the Netherlands or Germany, Norway, these kind of countries, their position vis-a-vis this ban can affect the United States. And the treaty will set up fora and that will... there'll be a continual drumbeat of shame, if you like, that the United States will have to deal with.
And how does it procedurally? How is it set up procedurally? Obviously, all these countries that are in the umbrella, in the Russia, in China, and U.S. have a stockpile of weapons. How would it be phased out in the treaty?
Yes, the treaty is silent. Basically, the way the treaty is set up now, the United States can't join until they get rid of nuclear weapons. And that's something that we really like about this draft. We don't want an easy slide into treaty compliance on the basis of a promise to do something in the future. We already have treaties like that, and they're not working out. We don't want a treaty that is based on the promise of doing something sometime in the future, because there's many a slip.
Now, what about India and Pakistan, who are also, you know, very militant with their nuclear weapons?
Well, India and Pakistan are in a kind of destructive dyad there. And they also will come under pressure. So what remains to be done is to create the means for pressure in these countries. And for those states and for many others, the financial pressures, the importance of human development issues are going to weigh very heavily on military investment, and we hope in a positive way. This treaty isn't everything. It's just one step. We think it's foundational. It's needed because the nuclear weapons states have begun to assert that the non-proliferation treaty gives to them an indefinitely extended right to retain their nuclear arsenals and threaten others with them, which, as we know in our country, converts itself into a moral responsibility to take care of the world and be the world's policeman with nuclear weapons.
Now we've been pushing, and we talked about this last time we talked to you, we've been pushing to so-called modernize our weapons. And I guess this also would be a deterrent, I would hope, to that movement. Explain how that plays into this treaty.
The U.S. Really every state is modernizing nuclear weapons. And from being in negotiations, this modernization is scaring the world. It's a huge amount of money. People are appalled by it. They're offended by it. I mean, when it's very hard for a diplomat, let's say from Africa, to go in the morning to a meeting about UN development goals, with your population at the verge of starvation, and then go to a meeting and where the U.S. is planning to spend $1 trillion on nuclear weapons.
And it's not just the money. Part of the modernization effort, as I understand it, is to make these nuclear weapons more tactical. They could be used in a much more casual way. I mean, up to now, part of the reason that nuclear weapons haven't been used since Nagasaki and Hiroshima is they're so devastating.
Right.
But if they can make them small enough to be used in a tactical way, then they become even more powerful in terms of threatening these smaller countries.
Yes, that's right. And so everyone sees that, I think. One of the features of this treaty is that it would prohibit any state party to the treaty to base nuclear weapons on state territory. So among the nuclear umbrella states, those which have bases, which are five countries in Europe, Turkey, Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany, and Italy, those countries could not join the treaty until the nuclear weapons left their territory.
So there's this almost a month of negotiations to finalize the text of the treaty. Then what would be the step? It would have to go back to each government in their legislature to ratify the treaty?
Yes, that's exactly right. It would be signed and ratified by each individual country, and so it would go from New York, from the end of this negotiation, assuming it's successful, on July 7th, it would go back to capitals and would be considered, and there would be calls back and forth. I don't think for most countries, they don't want to be the only ones out and, you know, taking the step all alone, but they won't be. There's plenty of good diplomats out there that could arrange this, and there would be some kind of signing ceremony. That would be the normal way this would happen, and I don't see any reason why it wouldn't proceed just like that.
Now, you say this has never happened before. There's a total ban. The agreements before have been to prevent the proliferation to other countries and to reduce the stockpiles. Explain the difference between the previous treaties and then this one.
This treaty bans the possession of nuclear weapons, and it is meant to be a universal ban. We internally at the study group call it universalizing because it's the best word we've been able to come up with. The treaty, as a positive obligation in the treaty, requires states parties to advance the purposes of the treaty and educate others and basically keep this issue in the public eye around the world to try to increase the normative pressure on the outlier states. So it gradually turns the present situation where nuclear weapons have somehow gained legitimacy in 72 or years, whatever it's been, because no one has, not no one, but they have been insufficiently opposed. This is a very formal way for a whole country to say, we oppose these weapons absolutely, categorically, and we are willing to make this political gesture. This is not an opinion. This is not like a group of Nobel laureates coming together or religious leaders. This is an entire country's signed permanent obligation and commitment. And it's a much weightier step.
Now, what about the countries that don't even admit that they have nuclear weapons? For example, Israel. And then, of course, will be brought up that terrorist groups probably have nuclear weapons. How does that play into this whole?
Other countries are not under the restraints that, say, Los Alamos lab employees are, that they can't discuss the Israeli nuclear arsenal. So everybody knows Israel has nuclear weapons. Israel is will be one of those outlier states, which is category which they are in many ways. Terrorist states our terrorist groups are outside international law by definition. Yeah. So.
And then, of course, Iran has signed this new agreement that is to limit their nuclear capabilities. Interestingly, today, of course, while Iran had a vibrant election that elected moderates, the turnout was the largest in maybe the history of Iran. At the same time, Trump was calling them terrorists, and here he is in Saudi Arabia, where there is no no democracy of any sort. Women don't have rights, and he's demonizing Iran. The irony of that is just crazy.
It's awful, really. At our house, we woke up in the morning saying, "Well, Trump has now got a lot of blood on his hands for supporting Saudi Arabia's war on the people of Yemen." And, you know, he may have come into the White House being only personally corrupt, but now he is corrupt in a much bigger way that American leaders get corrupt. And it's, you know, it's a sad tableau. It's easy for us to say here, you know, it's terrible for the people of Yemen. And one of the things we looked at in this treaty was, are there ways to misuse this treaty as a club, as a geopolitical club, to beat other countries with? And that's not a factor. So it is in the NPT, where the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, has become a kind of a hammer that the nuclear weapon states have used against, say, Iran, for purposes that don't necessarily, are not really entirely related to nuclear issues.
Tell us anything more you want to tell about the treaty, and then what can citizens do to support this, and who do they contact?
This is a rising process, and one of the most important things that I should have said at the beginning is this is the fruition. It's a fruit that has been grown by activists for decades. So lots of people have worked on nuclear issues in this country and other countries. Sometimes it seemed futile. But this is a fruit from all of that labor, the flame that many people kept burning. Not just recently, not just the groups that are involved in this right now, but for a long time. So that's an important thing to realize, that the present development is the result of a lot of work going back decades. On July 7th, we may see a treaty. And I think that for most people in the United States, it doesn't seem real yet, because it's how dare these countries, which are smaller and they don't have nuclear weapons or big militaries, how can they tell us what's right and what's wrong? Because might makes right, doesn't it? So I think that when people meet with their congressional representatives and about other issues, we need to start folding this in. The big issue is, what is the social contract here in this country? We're about to see a Trump budget, and it will cut the safety net to make room for more defense spending and more nuclear weapons spending. We need to realize that the civilizational forces around the world are trying to help us rein this in, and we need to bring this up. We don't need all these nuclear weapons. We don't need all this military spending, because our kids are going to be hurt by it, whether or not they ever explode. It's taken from their schooling. It's taken from their health care.
Okay, well, let's shift gears to here in New Mexico. On June 7th, here in Santa Fe, there will be a hearing of the Department of Congress that overlooks Los Alamos safety issues, the nuclear...
Defense Nuclear Facilities Safety Board.
They'll be holding a hearing on, again, the safety issues at Los Alamos. Every year, something goes wrong. There was a major accident in the last month of mishandling of dangerous nuclear materials that started a fire. They had to close down a whole building. Explain what this board is going to be talking about.
they're going to be talking about everything related to the safety of the main plutonium facility and plutonium operations at Los Alamos National Laboratory. It's meant to be a kind of wide-ranging discussion, and they want to bring out issues because the same issues keep repeating themselves. So this thing that caught fire, this waste, you know, it was a routine, quote, thing, just bad housekeeping, something that had been lying around for actually decades. We would think that all that stuff would have been cleaned up at previous house cleanings, but no. And there are recurring safety problems. There's a lack of investment in safety equipment. There's a preference for funding glitzy science programs over more routine safety investments like fire suppression or a high-quality ventilation system. Those are very expensive, and the lab has been pushing back on that. Preparing the facility to withstand the earthquake that they now know is possible, that's very expensive too. So these are relatively big investments, and they get in the way of building new buildings, of expanding other programs and making, you know, giant new facilities, multi-billion dollar facilities they'd like to build. But without this plutonium facility being safe, then even from the programmatic perspective, the laboratory and, in fact, the weapons complex is crippled.
Well, I mean, as I say, this has happened year after year. They'll make a report. They report, you know, 25 to 30 incidents of mishandling. The lab says, oh, we're going to fix that. 2 years later, there's a new report. There's a whole nother series of accidents. I mean, how can an institution like that, with all this money, not pay attention to safety? I mean, their own workers are there being exposed. I mean, it just is baffling to me.
Yes, well, part of the issue is that sometimes it's not their own workers. So sometimes it's a subcontractor. We got a call this morning, someone concerned about someone they know working for a subcontractor without personal protective equipment because no one told them to wear it. So this information doesn't get to the director's office. The director's office is concerned with how groovy it is to put a chem cam on Mars. We need to come down to Earth, take care of people, especially blue-collar people, because there's a big class problem in Los Alamos National Laboratory. And that is one of the core reasons for the problem. Another core reason is that the lab does not identify as a high-hazard nuclear facility. They identify as a science lab. But that's not just what they are. They have industrial processes there, and they don't think industrially.
Now, they are proposing, and they have for a long time, tried to increase plutonium pit production, and that's these grapefruit-sized balls of plutonium that are put in the center of a nuclear warhead. But so far, this has been stopped. But what is in the near future with Trump, you know, at the reins and a Republican Congress, is there a possibility that they really will proceed with this?
There's definitely a possibility. And we are on tenterhooks about tomorrow's budget. Will there be a line item for building an additional factory complex, or will they use the existing factory complex? Will they expand? The idea would be to build these underground workshop modules to remove some of the more dangerous activities. Not that don't want to imply that they're all very dangerous when it comes to plutonium, but these would be like casting plutonium when it's liquid and hot, and move that underground, just as dangerous or more dangerous for the workers, mind you. But if worst came to worst, then just the workers would die. It would not go into the environment. But it's a $3 billion project. And so is that going to be in the Trump budget or not? We don't know. Congressional staff, one person who's kind of funny, not given to a lot of words, said, we're waiting for this to collapse of its own absurdity. Well, I hope it does. But it's an absurd time.
And, of course, our own congressional delegation supports this expansion. How can people communicate their opposition to this to our own representatives?
When you write them, write publicly. Embarrass them. They are among the biggest hawks in Congress. People need to realize that. We often encounter people that think, well, they're so nice, and aren't they very liberal and environmental? Well, not really. No. They are, as somebody else said, moderate fascists. And they're not the most extreme, but they're very militaristic and very pro-nuclear weapons.
And part of that is that they get almost half their campaign contributions from either the military or nuclear contractors or the industrial military complex.
Yes, and I think we need to have some come-to-Jesus conversations in our environmental groups, in our churches, and elsewhere. We will fail on our justice goals, on our climate goals, on our environmental goals, on our education goals, on our safety net goals, if we cannot rein in and decrease the military-industrial complex that you mentioned, and especially its nuclear component, which is used to generate the fear that provides money for the whole.
Well, I've been very disappointed with environmental groups in Taos who have just championed both Heinrich and Udall as these great environmentalists, and just they don't seem to mention a peep about this other aspect.
That's very old-fashioned, I agree. But we have to get beyond that because these issues are all connected now. It's really decades behind the time. It's a kind of Republican environmentalism, if you will. And we need to recognize the overlap and the core identity of these issues and not let our elected representatives greenwash themselves. And it's an emergency situation. So the nuclear weapons is on a simmer. It's always on a simmer, and it boils from time to time. But the climate part of it is an emergency. And we need to stop what we're doing and reprioritize. But we can't neglect the fact that our country, if it has a military and imperial identity, it will never, ever address the climate issues in an effective way.
Okay, well, why don't you give your contact information and how people can get to your website and support your work?
Thanks, Robin. Greg, you could write us, Greg Mello, gmello@lasg.org. Our website is lasg.org. Phone number 505-265-1200. And we'll try to help however we can. We're just a little outfit.
Well, you've been at this for decades, and you're one of the most informed people. One of the things that people don't realize with the study group is that the military people and the Republican people listen to you. You have, solid information, and a lot of these changes where we have been able to stop have been because you talk to everybody.
Well, that's right, and you have to. And I think that there's a lot of opportunities for that. Meeting that I described where the congressional staff were talking about the absurdity of underground modules, there was a Republican in that little conversation there laughing because she knew also. And they care about management. They care about money. And these days on what we might consider to be the far right, there's a lot of pacifism and anti-war sentiment. And we need to be aware of that and look for common ground with the Ron Pauls, with the Paul Craig Roberts, people who we don't necessarily agree with about every single thing. That's just the nature of our political time.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Greg. We always enjoy talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You have been listening to Greg Mello, founder of the Los Alamos Study Group, recorded on May 23rd in Santa Fe at Collected Works. A little bit of noise from the cafe there. This is Robin Collier of KCEI.